Good morning, my name is Sharon Barker, I'm an alcoholic. I think we're doing pretty good on a Sunday morning here. We look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I never used to be in any place this bright on a Sunday morning. That's for sure. I very much want to thank Diane for asking me here, and Joe for having me and putting this on, and Diane for all her energy that she's given to me over the weekend and before that, and I think if I stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll definitely run into her and her people again, because that's what it's all about for me, is staying active and alive in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it renews me. And it's a privilege to be able to share with my people, which is you. Wouldn't have picked you years ago, but you probably wouldn't have picked me either. And I'm especially privileged to be with the set of speakers we've had all weekend. I hope you got to hear most of them. And I'm the new kid on the block with 18 years and 7 months and 1 week today. And I'm the new kid. So they're asking me to get them a cup of coffee, you know. But it's been a privilege to be with them this weekend. And Deanna, expressive, beautiful woman. I think I would have gotten in trouble with her if we would have known each other before. We've gotten to know each other a little bit, and I hope that's a friendship that grows. And I have a lot of old friends in this room. I guess I shouldn't say it that way. You might get a resentment, those of you who are thinking, as she mean me. Long-term friendships are in the room, and that's very special to me. And new friends, and two women I sponsor, beautiful Robin and beautiful Stacy, are here. And that's such a privilege, because sponsorship to me did give my life new meaning. It's a joy to be able to see them and to be with them and have them be such an important part of my life. And so thank you. Thank you for allowing me to feel closer to my God, which is what I feel when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what being a spiritual speaker is all about, other than I'm just going to share a little bit about my story and hope that somebody somewhere gets a little bit of a message, and maybe it'll be me, so, that's a self-obsessed thought, isn't that? I don't know how this thing works. It's just one self-obsessed person talking to another self-obsessed person, and once in a while we begin to listen to each other, but that's what it's all about for me, is being of service, so I'm grateful to be here on such a beautiful day. I grew up in the state of Iowa, and that was definitely my first resentment when I realized where I was and what was going on around me. It wasn't a turkey farm, but it was in the country, and it was a nice place to grow up. My parents still live in the same house I grew up in. About 5 years ago, they moved the house, but it's the same house. You know? So when I went home and I looked out of my bedroom window and there was a new view, I wondered if somebody had slipped me something at the airport, you know. But my parents are married over 52 years. I am the only non-alcoholic. I have two sisters and a brother. I'm it. And they knew something was off with me long before I knew it. Now when I go home, they're very supportive, and I've been at home for about 3 days. They look at their watch and say, isn't it time for a meeting? So they know what's wrong with me now, but nobody knew back then. It's just I was the nervous one and the one that always seemed to have the center of attention. And sound like I'm describing my son now, which makes my heart heavy. But it was just the way it was. I was the odd man out in my family, and I was the middle girl, and so I was the independent one, and I always felt that the mothership had left me off. So at an early age, I was obsessed with UFOs, and I would look for that mothership. And I did see some things in the sky, and I was hoping they were coming. And, you know, I did this huge term paper on UFOs when I was a child, and they just thought I was funny reading these magazines about UFO abductions and things. But I got good grades. I was very active. I was very social. I was part of the community. I was part of the church. And you can't hit a moving target. You can't pin it down either. And I was so active and so involved that I didn't know sometimes what I was supposed to be doing. But I just showed up, and I was ready for my first drink, I'll tell you. I was out on a country road. It was a 57 Chevy. I was with my neighbor boy. He was driving. He was 16, and he was older than me, and he had a little bit of a reputation, and we were out driving around one night, cruising around those country roads, and all of a sudden, kind of all met out in the country on a hot summer night. I think it was July, because it was the summer before my 14th birthday, and I had had a few sips here and there at those Czechoslovakian wedding dances, you know, because my mother would just push her screwdriver away, and I'd sip on it a little bit, and I seemed to be able to dance a little bit easier with Uncle Art, you know, but I didn't really remember getting drunk until that night, and I remember sitting on the hood of that car, and there were some other cars that came along, and I was very nervous, and I know I was, my hands were sweaty, and I felt very skinny and very knock-kneed and very flat-chested looking at all those other girls standing around me, and I just didn't feel a part of, but I was sitting on the hood of this car, and they got some Canadian Club out of the car and some Schlitz beer, and they started passing it around, and I took a couple hits, went right down, went around, came back again. I don't know when it happened, but all I know is I looked down, and my little flat chest seemed to grow bumps, you know? And I looked down at my little knock knees, and I seemed to have these Marilyn Monroe-type legs all of a sudden. And I slid off the top of that car, and Lauren Bacall happened. It was just an instant transformation. I learned to smoke cigarettes, chug a lug, tell dirty jokes, drive a car, dance, and I don't know what else that night because I blacked out. And when I came to that next morning and I was home in my bed, I knew I had a good time. What had happened was all those critical people that live in my head, you know, that alcoholic mind that I still have because it centers in the mind, stopped talking and just had fun. We all got drunk and we all had a good time. And I couldn't wait to do it again. Now, it was hard to get at that age, but I managed to get it, and I managed to get drunk a lot in high school, and I managed to get in some trouble, but my smokescreen of good grades and honor student and active in the community kept you from really looking at that until I went off to college. And when I went off to college, it was party time. Now, my sisters and my brother are all college graduates and have two or three degrees, and I never made it through. But I didn't go with the intention of really becoming an art teacher. Not really. I had a scholarship to Boulder, Colorado. I lived in Mount Vernon, Iowa. I should have been elated to go there. They flew me out there. I looked at the school. I had this art scholarship. I came back. I fell in love. First mistake. Second mistake was I gave up the scholarship to go to school 20 minutes from my home because of this man I fell in love with. So I wasn't making really smart decisions back then. I caught him with his tutor about 6 months later, and that was that. But I was going to the University of Iowa, and it was the late 60s. And I don't know about you, it wasn't the just say no generation. It was just say thanks. And we took a lot of stuff with our alcohol. We had a good time. I dropped out of the sorority, and I ended up living on a off campus in a house with some other girls that had dropped out of the sorority. We made a big deal about it, and we were real rebellious about it. And I started to attend the SDS rallies and the Black Panther rallies, and anybody that looked like they were having fun. I started to attend those rallies. It was a lot more exciting than it was going to those religion classes and psychology classes and those art education classes. And I started to take all of the painting classes I could and the creative classes I could, because I could be drunk, I could be high, and I could, you know, roll around on the canvas with my clothes on, paint on my clothes, which is what I did. I was known for that. That was the Jackson Pollock of my era, with putting the paint on my clothes and laying on the canvas. But I was creative, you know. And when you're stoned, it's a great place to lie for a while, you know. You really can make a nice little form on that. And so I had a good time. But the good time started to turn into, I don't know what's going on here and what's happening to me here and why do I wake up in the morning and slice my wrists? What's wrong with me? My father and the priest, family priest, came down to talk to me after that suicide attempt, and the priest and I got drunk that night. And my father didn't know what to do, and they sent me to a psychiatrist. And if you have a bad attitude and you fold your arms and you kick out your legs and you think, well, they're paying you, so figure it out. I'm not talking. They don't want to see you after a couple of visits. And my parents knew something was wrong with me, but I was in that I'll show you stage. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Now, that's a self-centered way of thinking, which I was living from. just let me hurt myself. I'm not hurting anybody but me. Very selfish thought. And I lived that way a long time. And I just went about my life, and my father began to do things like cut off the funds to college. He said, if you're going to have this kind of fun, then you can pay for it yourself. So I told him exactly what I thought of him and his generation and who he was and what he stood for and his government and his church and on and on and on. And I did not mince my words with my dad. And my father flexed his jaw and turned and walked away from me. And my dad and I didn't have a civil conversation for years after that, because I was going to tell him what I thought about him, because it's his fault, and you got the broad shoulders, Dad, and you can take it. And I began to blame people for my life. I dropped out of school and I went to New York, and I thought I could make it there, and I didn't know I was taking geographics. I had no idea that I was taking me with me. I had no idea I'd wake up in the morning and find me there. I got a job at an ad agency. It was the summer of Woodstock and orange sunshine, and I was looking for truth. I was drinking in the bars till they closed. They closed for about a half hour to clean up. I'd do some crystal methadrine, stick my hands in this bag of orange sunshine that I had, this LSD. I'd lick off my fingers. That was my vitamin C. I put on my little suits, and I go off to the Pan Am building where I worked in an ad agency, and then at lunchtime, we go out and drink for 2 hours. And I come back, close my door, maybe I'd sleep for a while, and then I'd go out to the bars, and I'd find my phrenologist who would read the bumps on my head. He would sit in the bar in his white turban and wait for me. And then I would go do the I Ching and find out about my life through the I Ching. And then I would go do the tarot cards, and then I would have my palm read. And then I would walk Central Park and meet the musicians, you know, and do some more crystal, do some more LSD, drink some more, and go find truth. And I know that truth came and went about 25 times that summer, but it was always so fast I couldn't write it down, you know, or it was melting. It would melt a lot off the wall. Truth would be written, it would melt, you know. And I, too, I had a ticket and a ride to Woodstock, and I couldn't get out of my apartment on the Upper West Side because I was too stoned on acid, sitting there with my bottle of wine, and I had the cockroach killing spree going. So they came to get me, and I couldn't get off my windowsill because the roaches were all coming out at me. So I sat on my windowsill while my friends went to Woodstock that weekend, and I don't know why I wasn't there. Maybe I would have died, but that was just my life, and I lived there for about 10 months, and I got so paranoid that when the mugger finally came, I was happy he was there. I had waited so long for him, and that's the way I began to live my life, and I went so crazy. I called my father and said, please let me go back to college. I'm serious this time, and I was about as serious as a minute. And my dad did let me go back to college, and my father and I had another big fight, and I ended up in Colorado. You know, I didn't know I was taking geographics. I had no idea that the baggage was getting heavier. I was beginning to live out of a backpack, too. I would hitchhike everywhere. I would hitchhike to the moratoriums, the peace marches, the love-ins, all of those things. I would hitchhike everywhere. And now if I couldn't put it in my backpack, I didn't want to own it. You know, I thought I was free. You know, the wind in my hair and my dog at my heels, I was free. And I ended up in Colorado and wanted to be a cowgirl and ended up working in an equestrian restaurant where one day Bob Dylan walked in. And I said, oh, my God, this is Bob Dylan. We're near Aspen. Could be him. It looks like Bob Dylan, my hero. And the man ordered a chocolate milkshake. So I went in the kitchen. I made two chocolate milkshakes to go. And I came out, put my waitress apron on the counter. I said to my boss, I'm taking a leave of absence. He says, you're fired. I said, I quit. I walked out the door, and I got in the car with the chocolate milkshakes and this man. I said, okay, Bob, where are we going? He said, California. You want to come? I said, yeah. And I don't really know if it was Bob Dylan or not. I'm not really certain. Looked like Bob Dylan. Sang like Bob Dylan. He was very spiritual, so I don't know. But I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach where it was going to be another start for me. You know, they panhandled for they did the welfare game and they panhandled. And I wasn't good at any of that. I had no self-worth and people wouldn't give me money and it was fine, you know. I tell them they don't, they say yeah, and they walk by, you know, and I get 50 cents after 4 hours on a corner. But I turned 21 out in Westwood, dancing with the Krishnas, panhandled for my wine. Yeah, I could panhandle for my wine. And I got drunk and I'm dancing with the Krishnas and I almost ended up with them that night. You know, I'd almost ended up with the Pentecostals in Colorado and the Jesus Freaks down on Laguna Beach. I almost ended up with those people because they had something I wanted. They had a light on in their eyes. And I thought, all right, they've got something. They've got truth. And then they'd say things like eternity and forever. And I go, oh, no, no, no. I do a day at a time here. Thank you very much. And I'd pick my stuff up and I'd walk. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys said it was a day at a time, I went, yeah, right. What do you really mean by that, you know? And they say, no, it's a day at a time. That hooked me a little bit here because I had lived a day at a time. Came back to Colorado, was a bad scene. I ended up at my mom and dad's house at 21 years old. I was a full-blown alcoholic. My father and I didn't speak. We could not walk down the same hallway at the same time. I was the loser of the family. I lived upstairs as long as I couldn't. Didn't take any drugs. My mother said I could stay there. So I went into those taverns, and I drank every night in those taverns in that small town, judging everybody in that small town. And I was sick, and I was lonely, and I was dying of alcoholism, and nobody knew it. And they took me to the family doctor because I would get very toxic and very sick, and the doctor said I needed some Valium. So he put me on Valium, and I found out later, about a year later, I had a non-functioning gallbladder. I had pancreatitis. I was very sick. And I was in the bar one night, and this guy walked in I had known from high school, and he looked mellow. And he said, let me take care of you. The music to my ears. I ended up going to northern Wisconsin to an organic farm where I thought it was going to be a rest. I thought I was going to have this surgery. They took out my gallbladder. The doctor said, look at you. What's wrong with you? You're too young for this. Do you abuse drugs? Do you abuse alcohol? I said, I'm organic, because by then I was already organic. And he said to me, you know, you shouldn't look like this at 21 years old. And they had surgery, and I ended up at this organic farm, and they took away my cigarettes and gave me organic pot to smoke all day long. And I was healing from this surgery and doing Adele Davis and eating right and all of that. And what happened was I had to get drunk every once in a while. And I get tired of that 50 head of organic sheep and that compost pile and that grinder that we'd have to put the wheat berries in to make our own bread. You know, the organic wheat berries in this grinder and make our own bread in the wood stove where we didn't heat with anything but wood, so we had to chop wood to even make tea in the morning. And it was cold. It was northern Wisconsin, and it was cold. I didn't shave my legs for a year because they were never exposed, you know. I remember standing up at the windmill, getting the windmill to go one morning because that was our pump, and I felt all this stuff coming through my legs. It was the wind through the hair on my legs. I had never felt that before in my life, you know. You know, it's God knows where else the hair grew, but it was a new experience for me. I had become organic, but every once in a while I'd have to get drunk because those little bottles of organic wine they gave me didn't do it, and I would end up going and getting drunk. And those people would look at me like, what's wrong with you? Can't you just smoke these? Why do you have to act like that? I put on my cowboy boots. I put on the Rolling Stones. You know, they'd like Pete Seeger and banjos, you know. And I'd start to party, and we'd have a good old time. And they'd just look at me like, what is wrong with you? And so there's nothing wrong with me. Alcohol's more fun than you. And I made a decision not to let anybody control and enjoy my drinking anymore. And that was it. That man that wanted to marry me and make a life with those 85 acres of organic land left, drove him away. They went off to primal therapy. I went and screamed at the sheep. I had a good time, you know. And I ended up with a half acre of organic marijuana that summer that I tended. I babied. I lovingly weeded. I harvested, and I had this dope in hefty bags ready to go sell it and get out of town. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm leaving. And I take it into town, except I forgot the dope at my dope deal. So I joined the carnival because it was there that night. And that's, they said, maybe your best thinking got you here, Sharon. And kind of had to look back on that decision as that was kind of, you know, just one of those spur of the moment. Gee, it sounds fun. I always wanted to be a gypsy. Didn't think it through at all, you know. And so me and my pot and my station wagon with the bald tires and the big sun painted on the hood and my dog and a few bits of clothing joined the carnival. And I had the pot, and they had the speed, and so we were instant friends, and we partied in town for 3 days, and you go, and then you leave. And I just thought, okay, this is great. You know, you leave your mess behind you. Just keep moving. You know, we moved through Wisconsin all the way through the Midwest and down about Arkansas. I thought I'd better call my mom. So I told Mom, I'm not at the farm anymore. I'm in Arkansas, and I'm running a shooting gallery with the carnival. And she started to cry. I can't talk to my dad, now my mom cries. And I don't know about you, but my mom was just, she was my anchor. She was the one who just, oh, Sharon's footloose and fancy free. She's the creative one. She's the social one. Just, she'll be okay. She'll calm down. Not with this one. She wasn't really ready to tell the relatives about this one. And I met him, and he was, oh, I just thought it was wonderful. And he had a pet skunk, and so we took up housekeeping on the road together, and we ended up down south, and I got real drunk one night, and I started a fight with somebody, and then I backed off, as I always did. I let the fight go, and I'd go away and watch it. I like to do that. And they got the show closed, you know, and the owner of the show was a little upset with me, and I don't know what happened, but two stops later, I woke up one morning to a knock at the door. It was 6 a.m. It was much too early for any of my friends. I don't know why I opened the door. But as they barged through, they put a shotgun in my belly and made me stand there as they searched the room. And by then, we had enough stuff to have sales and possession down in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And they didn't know quite what to do with us there other than throw us in maximum security. And I will never eat grits again as long as I live, I'll tell you that. So we all went to jail, the dog, him, me, the skunk, we all went to jail, and they didn't give me my rights. I screamed for my rights for 2 days, then they finally just handed them through the bars to tell me to shut up, you got your rights, and they did what they wanted, you know. It was one of those places where you don't shower alone, and so you don't shower, and I had called my brother-in-law, who in New York, when I finally got my phone call, and I guess he had called my dad, because they came one day about a week later, and they put handcuffs on me, put me in the car and took me to a building, and I walked into this office of an attorney, and there was my father sitting there, who he had flown down to New Orleans, taken a bus across Lake Pontchartrain, and had come to try to bail out daughter number two. And my dad couldn't look at me, and I couldn't look at him. And we sat inches away from each other. I couldn't reach out and touch him, and he couldn't touch me. And I hope I never forget how I felt that day. I felt like scum. But I wasn't going to tell him, because we've talked about that day, and he said the only thing I told him all day long was, I'm not guilty. See, it was never my fault, ever. I never took responsibility for anything in my life. And I began to really play the victim role. And he hired the attorney, and I didn't get out of jail. And the attorney and the bail bondsman and eventually the judge all split up the money that we had to pay him. But they did what they wanted to do, and that was just fine. But after 31 days, they cut me loose, and I found New Orleans. And I fell in love with New Orleans. And I started dancing on Bourbon Street, and I danced in a place that's still there today. And I used to like to dress up. My drag queen friends used to like to do my face makeup and my wig. I had a platinum blonde wig and wore these fishnet stockings. And I'd get up on that baby grand piano and pose and wait for my number to start. And then those fishnets would get stuck on the palm tree that stuck on the wall, you know, on the staples that were holding the prop to the wall. And I had the fishnet stuck, and I probably drank half a bottle of Cavassier just to get up on the baby grand, and because that's what the bartender liked to give me. And I'd be standing up there trying to get these fishnets off of the, you know, trying to smile and ready to kind of wiggle around for my number. And finally, I get these fishnets off of my legs that would just pour through the hole of this fishnet stocking, you know, and I'd be humiliated and embarrassed, but they loved it. They thought it was part of the act, and I would fall off that piano onto customers' laps, and I asked for a raise, and they fired me. So that was the end of my dancing career, and I became a bartender, and that's where I met Robin, who I sponsor today, who's got over 10 years of sobriety. And I met Robin, and then I met Denny, and the three of us were like the three musketeers in the French Quarter. And we lived and died down there. I don't know about you, but I never went out in the daylight. If it was daylight, we're in a bar, we stayed in the bar. The Bastille was one of my favorite, darkest bars. Nobody knew what time of day it was until somebody cracked open the door. I tended bar down there, and I got fired from one of the nice hotels for being drunk on the job, and then I worked local joints, because by then I could just take my Jose Cuervo Gold, and that put my name on the bottles. Nobody touched those bottles. They were mine. That's what I drank. And if you were a bartender, you came in, I took good care of you, because when I went into your bar, which was a local joint, after I was off, you'd take good care of me, and I'd have a tab. And that's just kind of the way it worked. And I remember one Mardi Gras working, I had been through a quart and a half of tequila as I was working, and my shift was like 5 hours into it. Wasn't even, you know, done. And I thought, gee, that's a lot of booze. And I was functioning. I was totally functioning. And I thought, isn't that a lot of booze? And I don't know where that thought came from. But I could drink 2 quarts of tequila a day, and then some days I'd sit there and be on my fourth rock glass, and I couldn't get off the bar stool. You know, I couldn't get off the bar stool. Or I'd be in a blackout where I'd come to out in the bayous, or in Florida driving the wrong way on a freeway, as I did with some people I didn't know once. And my blackouts were beginning to get longer, and I wasn't taking care of myself. And I'd wake up with blood on me and be grateful it wasn't mine and not know where it come from. Or I'd wake up half in and half out the door, not knowing if I'm coming or going. And Robin and Denny and I lived like that. We lived like that. And a lot of those people are dead. This boyfriend, his parole got pulled, and I should have been happy, but I had to go follow him. And the last time my parents saw me was with this guy, and I had a new black eye, and I introduced him as the love of my life as he put the snake in my father's face and called me four-letter words in front of my mom. My dad couldn't look at me, and my mother cried at lunch that day. And when they drove away to go to Iowa, you know, they just left any resemblance to daughter number two. She was gone, finished, done. And I was tired. You know, I was probably about 23 years old then, and I was done. And I didn't know it was alcoholism. I just knew that this was my lot in life, and it's your fault. I could always blame you. And I wanted to go back with them, and I wanted to just start over, but I knew it wouldn't happen. I knew it was over. There were no more hopes and dreams. There was no more Lauren Bacall. I began to puff up. I began to be one of those toxic alcoholic women. No, and I was one of those women that gained a lot of weight when she drank. And I began to not look good anymore. And I began to pass out with vomit in my hair. I began to vomit on the bar. I began to, as I said, wake up in places with people that I didn't know, doing things I didn't care to do. And I worked on Lower Decatur Street, was my last job down in the French Quarter. And it was a bar that even Robin and Denny didn't like to frequent, because you could smell the bathroom as you were walking down to where I was working. And I got fired for having a bad attitude from that job. The last Mardi Gras that I worked in New Orleans was in 1975. And my friend Michael, who was with me and partying, and he was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, he was a good guy. And I don't know why he had a gun and why he was shooting at people off the balcony of the place I was living at. But he was, and the police were called, and I was in a blackout when I came to. The shots had been fired, and Michael was lying dead to my left, 2 feet. And Norm Elke is a speaker. God, I love to hear Norm. He's not around anymore. But Norm used to talk about seconds and inches. And we've all got those moments in our life that we're privileged to be able to get our butts to the seat of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody who needs Alcoholics Anonymous will ever hear about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're the privileged ones, and it's by seconds and inches that we get to get here. For some reason, something happened someday that we ended up at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that day, it was seconds and inches if I was even going to live. And I ran, and I left town and ended up in New York and met some people writing a book, and I was the artist in the bars. You could be what you want to be the brain surgeon, I don't care. You know, just let me be who I want to be in the bars just for a moment. And these people were writing a book on American Indian arts and crafts. They got some money from a publishing house, and they drank like I drank. So we came across country looking for the Indians in all the bars. I was so depressing to them, they would drop me and leave me in places like Maryland and then come back and get me. And they were trying to help me control and enjoy my drinking because I was such a maudlin person to be with, and they would say, God, what's wrong with you? And it was that Thrifty's vodka you bought last night. Can't you buy some good stuff? You know, I had no idea that I was an alcoholic, none. I just knew I had to drink. That was my life. I ended up at Barney's Beanery in Southern California without a job and without any prospect of a job. I was hired for 10 minutes as a cocktail waitress. I was 170-plus pounds. I didn't fit in anything anymore. I didn't have a memory. I couldn't remember where the drinks went. They asked me to please leave and not come back. This guy, Andy, that I was with, he went on to other greater things, and I was kind of stuck by myself. And I met this girl named Chris who was nice to me, and I didn't know she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes part-time. But I remember one night in that bar, they had to call her a taxi cab to take her to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because she was too drunk to drive. So I took my rock glass full of gold, and I said, good for you, Chris. And I gave her a big toast as she went out to A&A. And I thought they taught you to drink. I had no idea, you know. And I stayed in that town for a little while, and it got really bad, and I called my sister, and she sent me an airline ticket, and I ended up back in New Orleans, where I remember getting off that plane. I remember seeing Robin and Brown and those people, and I remember feeling they didn't want me around anymore. You know, these were my running compadres. These were the quarter rats. We were compadres, and I remember even they didn't want me around anymore. And I met someone going to Hawaii, and I said, sure, let's go. I had DTs on him somewhere on the trip out, and he got scared, and he left me at that bar, Barney's Beanery, and I never saw him again, and I haven't been to Hawaii since. But I got on the back of a motorcycle on July 27th because somebody said, let's go party in Palm Springs. That's what I thought I heard him say. So me and my red dashiki and my Panama hat and my 170 pounds plopped on the back of that Harley Davidson. And I remember driving into Palm Springs that morning, you know, going, good morning to everybody. That was my wave. You know, it used to be the peace sign and the one finger. Now it's just the one finger. And I'm thinking how free I am. Look at these people in their nice cars and their nice clothes, and they have all those nice mortgages and nice bills and all these responsibilities, and I'm free. I'm on the back of a Harley, and I'm free, you know, and I'm drunk, and I'm obnoxious, and it's your fault, you know. And we went somewhere, and they left me at this nightclub, and I said, hey, I thought we were going to party. And they said, no, we needed a little extra weight for the back tire. It was windy going through the desert. We looked around Barney's, found the fattest one. It was you. Thanks a lot. See ya. And they left me there. They left me there. And I met the bar boys, and we went somewhere afterwards, and I was in a hideous blackout, one that I hope I never really recover from. It was one of those nights. And when I came to, we were in somewhere, an apartment somewhere, and they were kicking me in the face with their boots. And this wasn't a DT. I had a lot of violent DTs, that kind of stuff. But this was really happening. And they raped me, and at some point during the evening, I remember thinking, who the hell cares anyway? I gave up. I surrendered. I said, who the hell cares anyway? And I meant it. And I know nobody cared. And I gave up, and I just stopped screaming. And they broke my nose in three places, and they broke my jaw in three places, and they raped me and drug me around and took me outside and pulled me around on the cement a while, got me in the car, and took me outside of town and threw me off the side of a road where if you would have driven by that morning, you would not have seen me. I was face down, bleeding from my face, no clothes on, in a concussion, blacked out, should have just baked. Should have laid there and should have baked. But I heard the car door slam, and something inside of me, that survivor inside of me, just came to enough to hear a voice that said, get up, I want to live. I thought, who said that? It's not my fault, you know. And I did get up, and I did find somebody's condominium, and I guess I passed out a foot away from the pool. You'd have another speaker. It was seconds and inches. And a gardener found me, called the police. Next thing I remember, I'm lying on a gurney in a hospital. And I've got the police around me. And they're asking me those questions as they're prepping me for surgery, and I couldn't talk because my jaw was hanging off. And I had to write on this clipboard because I couldn't talk. And they're asking me, where were you? Who were you with? All those questions, you know, you don't know. And as I was writing on this clipboard, I saw a word in front of my name that made my heart stop. And if this broken face could have smiled, it would have smiled. Because what it said was victim. I thought, God, they know. They know. And as I was going into surgery that day, I heard that voice again. The voice said, it's not their fault. Who said that? It's not your dad's fault. Your sister, the Mensa. George, who broke your heart at 18. It's not their fault. You did this to you. I wasn't ready to have any sort of spiritual awakening, I'll tell you. I finally heard truth, and I didn't know what to do with it. But I have a wonderful, loving God with perfect timing in my life at all times. Because I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and no one sent me an airline ticket. First time. Nobody said, let's go start over in Phoenix, Arizona. I know you like that town. It's set out north, south, east, west, and they have drive-through liquor stores. I liked Phoenix. It was great. Nobody said that to me. I was left alone for 2 weeks in that hospital. When I got out, this guy said that I could come live with him. They caught the guys. I had to go to court. I had to go back to these surgeons. I was tired. I was not ready to go stick my thumb out anymore. I was scared, and I was alone, and I didn't care. And I sat above a liquor store every day when he would go off to work, and he'd buy me a gallon of red wine. I'd stick a straw on the top of that cheap red wine and stick a straw through the wires in my mouth where the tooth had been, and I would suck on that red wine all day long because I was on a liquid diet. But something changed with alcohol. The taste almost repulsed me. It didn't have that warmth in it anymore. It had no more, it's going to do it. It was gone. It was like drinking Kool-Aid. And I don't know how long I was there, a couple of weeks, and then he said, you're going to have to leave. You're too depressing. Moi? And I called my mom. What do you do when you're like that? You call your mom. When the chips are really down, mom will really come through. So I called her collect, of course. and I couldn't talk. And I said, Mom, I need some help. I need some money. And she said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? Who said that? My mom had gotten a phone call from someone in that hospital in Palm Springs that her daughter had, this had happened and this had happened to her, and they went over what had happened to me, and then hung up the phone, didn't tell her what hospital I was in. It took my mother and my sister 2 days to find me. For 2 nights, my mother didn't sleep. Paul talked about that. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given my mother a good night's sleep for the past 18 and a half years. I know what you mean. She said to me, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army, when everything inside of her wanted to say, Jesus, just come home and we'll do whatever we can. But nobody knew I was an alcoholic. Nobody. I didn't know. Nobody knew. Nobody told me. I didn't know. I wasn't ready to hear it. And when this guy told me I had to leave, and my mother said no, I called Chris, the girl from Barney's that was nice to me. The girl who'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't relate any of that morning. I just called her because her number was there, and I said, Chris, I need help. She said, Sharon, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. Chris wasn't sober that day, but Chris knew enough to turn me on to a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who had 5 years of sobriety. Chris died when she was 30 years old of this disease. She wasn't the pretty girl anymore. She was in a wheelchair with nobody home in her eyes, drooling on herself the last time I saw her. That's what alcohol will do to you if you let it just go. If alcohol will take every piece of life out of you, and I've seen it. Anybody who's been around a little bit of while has seen that happen to people that they know and love. And Chris never made it. But Chris got me to Suzanne. And Suzanne told me to put my drink and put my joint down. I thought, how does she know I have both? You know, she got my attention. And I sat on the steps of that liquor store, and these two beautiful women got out of this Volkswagen and started walking at me with, you know, looked like these gleaming white teeth and this clean flowing California hair, and I just hated them. I didn't, you know, there I sat in my broken huaraches, my jeans that were ripped, my 170 plus pounds, my bleach stained burgundy t-shirt, my broken jaw, my face is crooked, my nose is off to the side, I have raccoon eyes, my eyes were blood, just still bursted blood vessels, my hair hadn't been combed or washed. And I thought, what do they want from me? Arrogance of the alcoholic, I'll tell you. And they put me in the back of this Volkswagen, and they were sincere because I know I smelled bad. And they talked incessantly about themselves. I had this newspaper clipping in the pocket of my jeans in case they'd say, my God, what happened to you? Tell us, you know? But they didn't. They just talked about themselves. And we drive up to a church, and I go, oh, that's it. That's where we're going, and this is what we're going to do, that forever stuff. And I walk up to the man at the door with a tie on, and he looked really very dapper, and I thought he was going to just shoo me, or not even shake my hand, you know, or shake my hand and wipe it, as some people used to do. He shook my hand, and he sent one word to me, and the word was welcome. Wasn't ready for that. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know how y'all knew I was new. I had no idea. All I know was that if you would have stood at the door that night of that room and gone, smell a newcomer, where is she, where is he? I love that aroma. I don't get to smell it much anymore. Everybody goes through hospitals and treatments or whatever. They come out cleaned up, and I can't spot them sometimes, you know. And I like to walk in a meeting and smell the newcomer, you know. There's just something about it, you know. And those 12-step calls I used to get when I was new, I don't get those anymore like I used to get. Oh, if you get a chance, go. Go sit at somebody's bedside and read them the big book, and they don't remember a thing about it, and they'll come to the next morning with the big book and your phone number there. You know, I think it's a wonderful, sick joke, you know. I think it's great. But I used to do a lot of 12-step calls like that, and I don't get them anymore. Rarely do I get to go on them. If you get a chance, go. It's a wonderful experience. Your life will take on new meaning. But I was new, and they all gave me attention. I don't know what happened, other than the person that spoke said that he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I thought, God, he knows how I feel. So Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that night, and I had no idea that August 20th, 1975 was going to be my sobriety date. None. I don't even think I knew I was coming to AA for a couple of weeks. I was so out of it. I was one of those newcomers with the Rolodex brains. You ask me how I am, you better stand for 2 minutes and let me spin my brain for a while. And it would always land on the same card, and the card always said, fine. You know, after I had to think about how I felt, it was always fine. It was all I could do was to say. But I couldn't talk the first 3 months I was here. My mouth was wired shut. I had to learn to listen. It was really a blessing in disguise. And I started to hear. I started to hear things like, you better get a sponsor, you're going to get drunk. And by then I had 30-some days of sobriety. I'm going, wait a minute. I used to beat my fist on the bar to get a quicker drink. I always drank. Nobody kept me from drinking since that organic farm. There was a bottle in my bag as I had 14 shots lined up one day in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. I had to go and hit on the bottle in my bag in the bathroom. I was insatiable with alcohol. I couldn't stop drinking. And there I had over 30 days of sobriety. How did this happen? I don't know, but it's God's grace. And I began to think, well, maybe I'll stay here long enough to get through the court, because they caught these guys. I had to go through court. Go back to these surgeons and get this face put back together so I wouldn't have all these scars and just get my life a little bit in order, and then I'll hit the road again. So I was just kind of here to get well. But I got a sponsor because somebody goaded me into it. It was called peer pressure. So I asked this woman to be my sponsor. I had been sleeping on women's floors with this borrowed sleeping bag. All of a sudden I was sleeping on a couch. Now the minute I asked her to sponsor me, I got a couch. It was like, God, my life got better, you know? And it was that simple for me, you know, and I think I moved 2 paper bags into that couch instead of 1 when I came with, you know. And there I was, sleeping on the couch, and she had me hit my knees at night and wrote this little prayer. I couldn't remember it, but she said, you got to do this every night. If you're going to stay at my house and sleep on my couch, you have to hit your knees at night. And I said, okay. I'd wait for her to be dead asleep before I hit my knees. I'd read this little prayer, thank you for all you've given me, thank you for all you've taken away from me, and thank you for all you've left me. And I prayed to the sleeping bag. There was no big feeling, and I'd go to bed, and I'd sleep. And I'd sleep through the night. And I went to 2 meetings a day. I had to go, like I said, to court. Finally, the wires came off, and I had a bartending job all lined up, and they said, no, we don't think so. Maybe you should go be a food waitress for a while. I said, no, I'm a bartender. I'm not a food waitress. And they said, why don't you just try it for a while? You're not going to work around booze right now. And I took her judgment over mine. So that was a little bit of step 2 there for me. You know, she said I had taken step 1 because I had raised my hand for 30 days and gotten a sponsor and admitted my life was unmanageable. So she said that was the best I had to do, and I had taken step 1. And step 2 was I was beginning to listen to her over my insanity. I began to believe a little bit in her. And so I got this food waitress job, and I had a bad attitude, and I didn't make any money. So they taught me how to make an Al-Anon smile, so I did this all night long. This nice, teethy smile. And they'd ask me how I was, and I wouldn't tell them. I'd just say I was fine. And I made a lot of money. I used to tell people how I was and have a bad attitude, and I didn't make any money. So I learned how to be a good employee. When people ask you how you are, you don't tell them, unless you're in an AA meeting. You say you're fine, and you ask them how they are, and they want to talk, usually. They want hot food, and they get their hot food and their hot coffee, and you give them one of these, and they leave you money. So I did that, and my tips got better, and my life got better, and I began to have a $24 a week room. I got a teddy bear. I got my own telephone. I got a little car. I got a driver's license and insurance all in the same name. I got my first obscene phone call, and I felt great, you know. It was just like I felt like a real citizen. And my life started like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to meeting every day. I began to get commitments like Cookie Girl or making the coffee or, you know, set up or clean up. And I had commitments at my meetings, and I began to feel a little bit better about myself. Then she said, we got to take step 3. I said, well, what's that? And she read it to me, and she said, come to my house tomorrow. And I went to her house, and we, in the middle of the day, with the curtains open, got on our knees in her living room floor. And her kids were there. And I felt like the biggest, silliest person. And she was all excited, and we read this third step on our knees. And she jumped up, and we gave me this long hug. And she was a short little woman. She was, like, buried right here, and just hugged me. She wouldn't stop hugging me, you know, and then it started to feel good, so then I thought I must be gay, you know. I fought with that one for a while, you know. I had no idea that this is unconditional love. I hadn't been open to that ever, and I was beginning to just a little bit, just a smidge be open to being loved by somebody who really didn't want anything from me. And And we started working on our fourth step, and then I got waylaid and met him. And this other guy, that this one with the carnival with the black eyes and the heroin habit, and he'd be laying face down and say, "Let's party," and "I'm a speed freak," and "Let's go, go, go." And we would just never, 2 years, we just never got it together. And, you know, he'd punch me out, pass out from his heroin, I'd kick him. You know, that was true love for 2 years while I was drinking. I thought that was life. His parole got pulled. He went to St. Louis. I followed him there. I found him after a couple of months of living in that town. He got off his Harley, took his helmet off, he cracked the window open, pulled me out through my hair, spit in my face, said, "If I ever see you again, I will kill you." And that's when I knew the relationship was over. And that's what I knew about love. That's what I knew about love. You know, so there I am meeting this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who has 6 more months than me, had worked the steps, let me read his inventory. I knew all about him, you know. Writing me poetry, bringing me flowers. I said, "Well, this is okay." You know, so we forgot that fourth step for a while because we were joined at the hip, you know. I had a new higher power. And one night my sponsor walked by clicking her heels as she did. And Janet used to wear a hot pants, pink hot pants, a chartreuse bow in her hair, like bright green top and little socks that were probably purple and red high heels. I mean, Janet was, you could spot her in a room. I'll tell you, I always knew when my sponsor was there, it was neon floating around. And she was there one night. She walked by clicking those high heels, and she said to me, "You better get your own sponsor. You're going to get drunk." And she clicked those heels on by me, and I just thought, I'm standing here sharing with newcomers. Now you're telling them I don't have a higher power? You piss me off, you know? And I thought, okay, Janet, fine, come here. Look at that Beacon's truck. See that Beacon's truck? That's my higher power. Because it's like I rode around the country in the back of a Beacon's truck, and God always wrapped me in those quilted things, you know. And I made it to my destination. It's got a little knob off here, a scratch on the dresser. The drawer's a little askew, but we made it. So Beacon's is my higher power. I thought I was going to make her mad. And she just looked at me in front of these people, and she said, "Good, as long as it's not you." And she walked on by. So I prayed to Beacon's for a long time just to make her mad. Motives didn't have to count for a long time in my early sobriety. I did a lot of things just to make my sponsor mad or keep her off my back. And I still see Beacon's trucks today, and every time I do, I just get this warm feeling that everything is going to be okay, you know? My son points them out when we're on the road now, you know? So it doesn't matter. As long as it's not you, start somewhere. And that was my start for me. And then I did that fourth step because she made me mad one night. I was at the airport leaving to go have my slip. I was 11 months sober, and if I stayed here for a year, I'd be here forever, so I better go have my slip now. So I called her from the airport going to Vegas with my new credit card, and I said, "I'll be back. I'm just going to have my slip. I thought I'd tell you, don't worry about me." Because I had been taught to call her every day, no matter what, you know. And she told me this Stella story. I think they go to sponsorship school, and they learn these stories for when you're at a crisis in your life. They take out this sponsor Bible, and they look things up, because the Stella story worked for me. And she just had it like that. She said, "Be like my friend Stella. She has long hair, raven hair, beauty. She wouldn't finish her fourth step either," she added. And she went out and had her slip at 11 months of sobriety and burned up in a bed. Go have fun. Well, all I could think of is how I'd look burned up in a bed. I mean, I always wanted to be like Janis Joplin, you know, live fast, die young, you know. And I thought about burned up in a bed, and she made me so mad. She took the wind out of my sails. I sat at the coffee shop, and I wrote. My anger was stronger than my fear. I didn't know I was such an angry person. I had no idea, but she knew. And we did my fifth step before I was a year sober, right before I took my one-year cake. And my friend Pat, who has 8 days less than me, that's the clue, 8 days less than me, used to look at me when they'd read chapter 5 and they'd get to steps 4 and 5, and she'd give me that thin little blue lip look. Like, "I've done my inventory. I know you haven't done your inventory." And I think about going out a lot, and I thought, no, I have less time than Pat. I can't do that, you know. So when they read that chapter 5 that night after I had done my fifth step that night before all night with her on the beach in Venice, I just smiled at her. And I felt so good about sitting in that seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't matter what your motives are. Pat and I still share birthdays every August, and I still have eight more days than Pat, always. So that doesn't matter what keeps you here. And then I'm going along in my sobriety without any defects of character because they're all his anyway. And I go to women's stags, and I didn't have anything to say. I just sit there, and I go home that night and feel lonely because I hadn't shared with anybody. And I go through the book. I thought, oh, they won't understand. They don't have a relationship. Oh, they won't understand. They're too old. Well, I haven't talked to that person in a long time. And I go through that book and I close that book and I go to bed feeling lonely. I wasn't sharing. I wasn't talking to other women. I was beginning to resent having to go to a women's meeting. And one night there, I had a problem and it blurted out of my mouth. And I didn't like any of the solutions I got. I judged every solution that was given to me. But I went home that night and I felt better because I was in the solution, not in the problem. And it began to change for me. And I'm a very solution-oriented person, very solution-oriented. I wake up in the morning, if there's something on my mind, I think about where I can go with it and how I can make it a part of my life or what I have to do to get it out of my mind. It's with action for me. I don't sit in bed in the morning and listen to my head because my alcoholism is in my mind. It starts there. It will set me up to get me to a bar to order a rock glass full of Jose Cuervo Gold. And I don't listen to my head. My feet are my friend. My feet take me to meetings. My feet take me to my job where I'm supposed to be. My feet take me to pick up my son at school and take him to his drum lessons and his little other lessons he's taking, gymnastics, whatever. My feet make me responsible and allow me to feel good about myself because they take me where I'm supposed to go, and I don't listen to my head. You know, I'm not sure sometimes if they change clothes in the middle of the night and who's on my side and who's not on my side. I think I have them all down to who's good and who's bad and it's wrong. So I don't even listen to them. I have a sponsor louder than my head. I always have had. You know, his name is Clancy now, so you know he's louder than my head. But I've always had a sponsor louder than my head. Janet was my sponsor for the first 4 years I was here, and Jenny was my sponsor for 5 years after that. And they taught me how to be a woman. And they taught me how to become soft. And they taught me how to be feminine. And they taught me how to dress. And, you know, I learned all that stuff in 4-H growing up. You know, I learned. But I had lost any bit of dignity at all about being a woman that I had. And something happened to me at 7 years of sobriety when I stood and took my cake. From the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, I felt like a human being. Complete God's kid human being. And I realized the innocence had come back. Boy, that was something I didn't think would ever come back. But the innocence has come back, and the hope has come back. And I have dreams and goals today. This marriage, my dad came out to the wedding and walked me down the aisle, looked at all of you, went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, bought a big book, and said, Sharon, your life, look at your life. You got it made. God, Dad, the angels are going to sing. You just gave me approval. You know? But they didn't. Because what happened was I said, yeah, you're right, Dad. I already had my own approval, just a little bit, just enough to acknowledge that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And my dad went home, and it was still tense with me and my dad. When Jenny became my sponsor at 5 years of sobriety, she had me, we worked on some character defects is what happened. I began to cop to my own. You know, when you throw the eggs, you got to clean them up. Nobody else is going to. And I began to look at my anger. I began to look at some other defects of character that I had. I began to put my hands in my pocket, and I began to change. I began to count to 10. I began to not be so quick with my mouth. I began to be more of a part of and sit back and be a member instead of always out there with a cause. You know, and Jenny had me soften up a lot. And that was good because... I began to be able to be responsible for my own defects of character. I began to be able to tell her what they were. I was so at a loss of what they had done to me, you know, and I began to stop being as much of a victim with her. And she lovingly and maternally healed me because of that. And I called my dad and I asked him how much money I owed him because she told me to do that. You know, I had made my written amends. I had done all that with him. I had made a lot of amends in my life. And I said, well, what is this money stuff? It's been so long. And she said, why don't you call him and ask him how much it is? And I thought, well, okay, he'll take a while to think about it. But I called up my dad, who gave me a figure without even missing a beat, you know? He had gone home, read the big book, and put a calculator tape in it and said, when Sharon calls, give her the bottom line, you know, and she will call if she gets here. So I called up Jenny, and I said, it's too much, it's too high, and he was too fast. And she said, I don't care. Loving sponsor. She said, are you really willing to grow? You know, they wait for you to be a little bit willing, you know, to have a little pain, and then they kind of really lay it on you. You know, they get you back to the wall, stick the finger in your chest, and okay, whatever, you know. And so I called him back, and I asked him I told him how much I was going to pay him every month, and it was okay. He accepted my terms. I called him back, and she said he accepted. I told her he accepted, and she said, okay, then, you know, if you're really willing to grow through this and heal this relationship, I want you to put a note with that check, with your dad's check, every month. A note about your life. I said, he didn't care about my life. She said, I don't care that you think he doesn't care. You do it anyway. So I would do it on tiny pieces of paper, about this big, because I know she'd ask. You know, I'm 5, 6 years sober acting like this, but I'm doing it anyway. And it would be 2 sentences and go with a check, and she'd say, you write your note? I'd say, yeah, I wrote the note. And that check would go. She said, without fail, do not be late. You're the example of the big book that your father has seen. You are not late with that check. And I called her one time, and I said, I don't have it this month. And she said, I don't care. He's putting it into a trust fund for you. I said, oh, good. I can buy that Jaguar then when he'll give it all back to me at the end, right? And she said, that's right. So I sent it early for about 4 months, I think. You know, that one lasted. The notes got longer. Father's Day cards weren't hard to pick out. I remember his birthday, and we were able to have conversations on the phone that weren't so tense. It was beginning to happen without me even knowing it. Between Christmas and New Year's one year, my dad called me and he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want any more of your money. I don't want your checks anymore. Don't send me any more of your checks. But don't stop sending me your notes. And me and my dad got to walk into a brand new relationship because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of a sponsor that believed more in me than I believed in myself. And wants more for me than I want for myself most of the time. I think I can't do things, and my sponsors say, you can. Try. And so me and my dad, I get to be his little girl, I get to be his best friend, I get to be his daughter, I get to be whatever I want to be with my dad, because there's no guilt there anymore from me. I get to quit being the victim with my dad. And it's such a joyous gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And when I started really sponsoring people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had some problems with my husband. I went to Al-Anon. He became a punk rocker. It was really tough. I used to put his albums in the oven and cook them. The Dead Kennedys, Fear, some of those. Not that I didn't mind him. I mean, I tried. I went to a Cramps concert with him. I would spike out my hair. I wore black leather. I made a shirt that said My Doll, and we went to a Cramps concert. It was great, you know. They're out there pogoing around and slam dancing, and, you know, he gets a broken nose. He's happy. This guy's stone cold sober. I'm standing there at the wall like this going, I've already done this. You know, I don't need to do this anymore. And I kept going to Al-Anon and going to my AA meetings and not burning up his records anymore. And I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and there he was sitting there learning to release me. And we looked at each other, and we both started to laugh, and we started to hike that summer, and I got pregnant. Now, I don't know if it was the high Sierras or what, but I hadn't ever been pregnant before in my life. And on June 23rd, 1984, Wesley was born. And I took hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD, and I counted those fingers and I counted those toes, and I was grateful. And that little guy smiled up at me with a dimple, and I said, yeah, thank you, God. I became so happy with Mommy and Me classes and daytime meetings and, you know, singing all the children's sing-along songs, the We Sing songs, and I just turned into mush. It was really something new for me, and everybody else would look at me too like she's singing Toyland with gusto. And I got to do that for a year and a half. I got to have a part-time job and spend a lot of time being a mom, and then what happened was he decided he wanted to leave. It was January, and it was 1986, and he decided he wanted to not be married anymore, and I had to let him go. I couldn't lay down and be the doormat that I had been before in my life, because you taught me that. I couldn't hang on his leg, you know, and say, please don't leave me, I'll do anything, because I know that's not the way it is anymore for me. I had to let him walk, and it was a painful, painful thing for me. I'm in a big group of people. I'm in the Pacific group. I got sober there, and I'm still there. And nobody got custody of the meetings, you know, and he was there and I was there. And then all of a sudden he and her were there, and I thought, when did her start? And how come they didn't tell me about it? And I was mad at all my friends, and I became the victim again. And I went to pick up my sponsor who had came back from Paris, and she had 21 days of sobriety instead of 21 years. And I had to go get a new sponsor. I was devastated. And I asked Clancy to be my sponsor because he had been there, and I figured I couldn't run him out of town. And I was real insecure, and I went and asked him to be my sponsor, and he walked me through that year of pain I had of living in the Pacific group in a closed environment with him and her there. And there were nights that, I tell you, I had two hot cups of black coffee in my hand, and I had heard some speakers somewhere talk about you can't be spiritual with hot coffee, it spilled all over you. So I was on my way. Two big hot cups one night. They were having fun Saturday night. It was always the night, Saturday night. You know, I never had my date, and he was always with her. And so I was on my way, and he happened to be in town that night, my sponsor, who was not around a lot. And he took me by the side, took the coffee out of my hands, and he grabbed me by the shoulders and lovingly made me stop and made me look in his eyes and said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace." And I'll tell you what I would have thought if he would have stopped right there to dignity and grace was my one-finger salute. Because I didn't care about dignity and grace. I was in too much pain. But he added, "So that you can be an example for the others." And I heard him. I don't know why I heard him. It was God's gift that I heard him. But I heard him. So I started working the steps again on me instead of them. And they had a baby and got married. And there I was at their son's one-year birthday party dishing up ice cream. I thought, how'd I get here, you know? Because my kid wanted to come to his half-brother's one-year party. And they were asking me to stand for pictures. And I was kind of, you know, hip cock, one half of a smile. You know, I used to give the finger at my boss under the desk all the time and smile above the desk, you know. And he never knew it for 4 years, you know. I felt like that that day. And I found later that I kind of liked her, that she was kind of nice. And she wasn't what I thought she was. So we would start doing things with the kids occasionally. Occasionally. And I started to like her a little bit more. I thought, wait a minute, where's this coming from? And we go to the Yuccaholics down there every year. It's our little event we go to. And we give the kids to him, and we go out and do this laughter with sober alcoholics. And we just went skiing about a month ago together. And they've been divorced for a couple of years, so it's a lot easier now than it was before. But she said when he left her, that she knew she could make it because of me, that I had walked through it with dignity and grace. You never know who's looking. We just went to her 10-year AA birthday party and tried to take a family picture on the fireplace. And I've got my son, she's got her son, and he's got his new wife and her little girl. And we're all kind of shifting around for the best position on the fireplace, you know, and the kids are jumping on each other's laps. And there's this newcomer over there, and I'm hearing this woman trying to explain to this newcomer who's married to who and who belongs to who and who's married to who now. And, you know, I just call Jill my ex-stepwife, you know. And but we all mugged for the camera, and the pictures came out real nice, except wife number three is not smiling very much yet. But she'll get used to it. She'll get used to it. Debbie's in Al-Anon, and she works a great program, and it seems to be working. And a couple years ago, he had a heart attack. And I don't know if it was his lifestyle or what, but he was a young man. And we were all surprised. And I told my son what he was going to look like walking in. And, you know, so don't be afraid if your dad looks like this. And my son walked right up to him, grabbed his dad's hand, started talking to him. And I walked in and fell apart. I thought, where is this coming from? I've got this great man in my life. I've had this great man in my life for a number of years, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, who matches my spirit, who tickles my soul. Where is this coming from, this feeling of intense pain for my ex-husband? And he was having leg cramps, and he couldn't get the nurse to come. And so you taught me to be of service. So I pulled up the covers. I started rubbing out his leg cramps. And it hit me when I was doing that, that I had never wished this man everything he wants out of life. I'd prayed for him a lot, you know, through gritted teeth. But I had never wished him everything he wants out of life. And I was able to do that at that moment because you taught me to be of service. And when I'm of service, the light goes on so much of the time in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a lot of opportunities that I never had before, which is being one of God's kids. I had never allowed myself to be one of God's kids. My son, who's now 9, has taught me how to play. I know how to do Legos. We put together puzzles. He said to me, "Mom, you can't do a cartwheel, can you?" Let me show you. I'm a single mom. I have a job at a law firm. I've been there 7 years. They promoted me twice. They know nothing about me. They say, good morning, how are you? I tell them, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? You know, I close my door and call one of you if they're looking at me funny. You know, and I just walk around there laughing all day long because I know who's really in control. You know, I know who's in charge, who has the power. I have a good time with these Harvard graduates. I'm real loose with them, you know, and I don't know why other than I know God's in charge, not them. You know I suit up and show up and do the best I can. And besides, I trip over beacon boxes all day long. They're always stuck in the hallway, you know. I have the privilege of sponsoring a lot of people of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to sponsor a nun. I get to tell Sheila on a weekly basis to have faith. It's a joy. You know, it's really a joy. She helped me heal with the anger I had towards the Catholic Church. My son goes to a parochial school where the nun is one of us. He got kicked out of kindergarten, so I had to do something with him. And he found that discipline works for him. He wears a uniform every day. He knows where he's going. He's in a safe environment. It's very protected. And he's doing math that makes me tired, you know. He's doing a great job. And he's a wild, vivacious, active, want-to-do-it-all, perfectionist kid with a lot of potential. And that scares me. And I hope to God that I am a keeper of the traditions, as I hope you're a keeper of the traditions. Someday my kid or your kid might need Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope when they walk in here, they find one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. I hope we don't water it down for our kids. Yeah, I really, really feel it. Well, enough of that. But I met Stacy. Stacy was a lost Rodeo leather girl when I met her. And she moved to San Francisco. She's got her own showroom, and she's got light in her eyes, and she sponsors a lot of women and passes the big book along and the steps in the big book along. And Robin, who I drank with and died with and went back to New Orleans in 1980 for the International Convention and made my amends in that town, I got to try to 12-step Robin, and she doesn't remember it. And years ago, she called me and she said that she was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then they called me later and they told me Denny was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And her brother is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she worried about her mom. And her mom's here with almost 3 years of sobriety today, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Her sister has 12 years. Her brother's got time. Tim is here. I sponsor his sister, who I love dearly, Cindy. And Cindy wanted Tim to get it, and he's here with 6 months of sobriety. I just get to be just a little part of all the miracles that happen around me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just get to be inside of it all. It's such a joy. When I hold hands in the Lord's Prayer, I'm inside of it all. And I get that joy of living and that zest for life. I got to go back to New Orleans a couple years ago, and it was Robin's birthday, and we got to celebrate and go to Antoine's. I had always wanted to go to Antoine's, and I was always so drunk I never made it. Never, ever made it to Antoine's. And we got a private room, and I was with the man I love, Casey, and he looked great, and Denny was there looking great with the man she loves, and Robin and her husband were there, and Robin even had a mink coat. I mean, it was just like they gave us this private room in Antoine's. Who did they know they had there, you know? It was ex-drunks. It was great. And we walked down Bourbon Street to try to 12-step a jazz singer we know. And as we were walking down Bourbon Street, and I was looking inside those bars and looking down the street, you know, I'd see somebody throwing up or passed out on the bar or duking it out with somebody. I thought, God, it's just seconds and inches between them and me. You know, and I had this glow of life. It starts in the inside because I've had spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, the central fact of my life today is that God has entered into my heart and my mind in a way that is indeed miraculous. He talks about that, and there's a solution. You know, I have done nothing. You know, God has done everything for me. I used to think freedom was just another word for nothing left to lose. Boy, I live by it. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found I had to give up. I had to surrender. I had to wave the white flag. I had to say, I have no more ideas. In order to get anything back, I had to give up. I never understood that. I never gave up. And I came to you, surrendered, physically, mentally, spiritually, a broken, beaten woman. And you didn't say, God, go sit in the kitchen. till you clean up a little bit. You put me right in front, you handed me a big book, and you told me what I needed to do, which was pick up the simple set of spiritual tools. You laid them at my feet and they said, you got to do the work. This is what we did. Nobody ever here has ever told me what to do. They've shared with me what they've done. Nobody has ever said to me, that's too sick for Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you better leave. No. People have loved me and people have cared about me. And I get to give that back on a daily basis because I'm a part of you on a daily basis. Alcoholics Anonymous is my freedom. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my dignity. I hope that today you just go out and be just a little bit a part of the force for good, which is living your principles sober out in the streets. Thanks so much for having me.